From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Monday, October 4th.
You had this broad liquefaction of American confidence in the government, and that opened the door to somebody who was, in this case, Donald Trump, who was essentially running against government.
That was Evan Osno, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. We'll get into Evan's new book a little later on, but first, your morning headlines. We begin with COVID. The United States reached another dark milestone over the weekend, passing 700,000 deaths from the pandemic. According to The New York Times, the majority of the 100,000 people who died in the last 3.5 months were unvaccinated. Dr. Anthony Fauci shared his reaction about the death toll on CNN.
We do have interventions in the form of a vaccine to prevent infection, to prevent severe disease, to prevent death. So when you see a number like this, I would hope people would say, well, we have a tool to not let that get any worse.
Israel, a country that's had remarkable success in fighting COVID, introduced new rules for determining coronavirus vaccination status. In Israel, to be considered fully vaccinated, you have to receive your second dose within the last 6 months or tested positive for COVID in that time period. They're also requiring booster shots 6 months after your second dose for anyone 12 and older. The Israeli government has been using the Pfizer vaccine. Next to Florida, which has become a hotspot for pro-abortion activism, thousands gathered across the state carrying signs with slogans like "Don't Texas, My Florida," in an effort to stop a Republican proposal that would ban most abortions. The proposed law would allow private citizens to sue anyone aiding an abortion procedure, which is currently the law in Texas. Unlike the Texas law, the Florida proposal allows for exemptions for rape, incest, or medical emergencies that threaten the mother's life. Finally, we end in California, where officials warned of a potential ecological disaster after 126,000 gallons of oil leaked from an offshore rig. The leak was initially reported on Saturday afternoon. It's the largest oil spill in the state's history. The leak has been patched up, but isn't completely plugged. Despite efforts to contain the spill, dead fish and birds covered in oil have started to wash ashore. In Huntington Beach, the leak caused officials to cancel the final day of the popular air show that normally draws 1.5 million visitors. And now to our daily deep dive. When New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, a veteran foreign correspondent, returned to the U.S. in 2013, he found a country that was unrecognizable from the one he'd left in 2002. Suddenly, it was a place with deep political fissures, with little to no common ground. Evan's new book, Wildland, The Making of America's Fury, is the result of his efforts to explain what had happened. I want to welcome my friend, Evan Osnos. Evan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rena. Thanks for the invitation.
I know you've been working on this book for quite some time, and you've thought through so many things, our country in such a different point than it was for decades. What really motivated you to write this book?
I think the truth is that I was alarmed by coming back to my country after a decade away. And it wasn't just that there was obviously gridlock in Washington or a level of polarization. It felt to me as if we had really lost this specific American thing. And I don't want to romanticize it because it was never a perfect, good old, you know, golden age. But we have had this ability to see the country as larger than the sum of its parts. And in the grandest terms, that's e pluribus unum. But the idea that we can do that, and what really struck me when I came back was it felt as if that vision had failed us and we were less than the sum of our parts. And that struck me as that sort of demanded some closer looking, actually try to document what it means to be American in the early 21st century.
So what were the questions you were hoping to answer with this book?
I wanted to go at the question of political culture. I wanted to understand things like, what do people trust and what do they not trust? What are the sources of security and insecurity in their lives? What are the ways in which they feel as if the country is fulfilling or not fulfilling their values? I mean, honestly, Rena, I think it's closer to how a foreign correspondent approaches a country than typically how we look at our own country. And that was partly by design. I mean, I wanted to do something that was a little bit of a step back. So I'll give you one example. I mean, I wanted to understand in particular segregation in various parts of the country. By that, I mean racial segregation, but also segregation by class and segregation of the mind, the way in which we have receded into these pockets of American experience, how all of these different kinds of segregated experience were contributing to that broader sense of disillusion.
You spent 6 years reporting this book. You focused on three major American cities, Greenwich, Connecticut, Clarksburg, West Virginia, and Chicago, Illinois. These are all places where you've lived. But why these particular places?
I thought they would give me very different impressions of America. And that proved to be the case. I mean, just in brief terms, they are quite different places. Clarksburg, West Virginia is a small city in the northern part of the state. It's coal country. I lived in Clarksburg for my first job out of college. And it's a place that has been, in its own way, sort of tumbling through the last 40 years of American economics. And it is also a place that has transformed politically from being mostly all Democrats to being almost entirely conservative. And I wanted to understand why and how. In Chicago, of course, which is a place that my family is originally from, I worked at the Chicago Tribune for 9 years. It's the place in America that is perhaps the most durable and in many ways maddening demonstration of the effects of segregation, particularly racial segregation, on health and wealth and outcomes. And then Greenwich, Connecticut, which is where I had grown up as a kid, is a wealthy New York City suburb. And it's also, in some ways, the engine room of American capitalism. It's a place going all the way back to the 19th century. You can get a window into the decisions and the values that are guiding American economic decision-making. So all three of these places, they have all played some role in my life. And I suppose it was just the most wildly unoriginal thing to go to three places I've lived. But I felt as if I could actually have some sense of change over time by going there, rather than just parachuting in for the first time and trying to understand what makes it.
So your book follows three people as they sort of navigate these varied landscapes of 21st century America. What do you think it is that their stories reveal about the United States?
In various ways, they convey, I think, the sense of precariousness. And that, curiously enough, applies not only to people at the bottom, but also to people at the top, because the sense that the stakes of winning and losing in this country, economically, politically, the sense that those stakes have become so large pushes people to make frantic choices. I'll give you an example. I think we usually associate that with, let's say, desperate people in the economy who voted for Donald Trump because they imagined that he would somehow deliver on fantastical promises to revive their jobs. That we've sort of already built into our understanding of the Trump phenomenon. But I think actually the more surprising example is somebody in Greenwich, Connecticut, who I interviewed, who was a lawyer who ended up being arrested in the college admissions case known as Varsity Blues because he had paid $75,000 to change the results of his daughter's college entrance exam. And he was on a FBI wiretap saying, "The moral element of this doesn't bother me." And I interviewed him for this and I said, "What possessed you?" And he said, "I honestly thought that I was in a corrupt system. And if I didn't do something to advantage myself and my family, that we would be disadvantaged."
Wow.
For me, there was a learning from that, which is that the sense that America's permission of a certain kind of corruption in American life has created a sense of desperation. And that breeds all kinds of other trouble down the line.
Speaking of other trouble, in the book, you mentioned that in 1964, 77% of Americans said that they generally trusted the government. By 2014, only 18% did. What happened here?
Two different things happened that are both important. One is that, particularly among a certain brand of conservatism, there was a determined effort to undermine confidence in the state and to say the government is not going to protect you. In fact, it's going to impede your ability to prosper. That became a certain kind of, call it small government prosperity gospel. And then there's this other thing that happened, which is that among other people on the political spectrum, there was a gradual loss of confidence in the ability of the state to tell the truth, to deliver on its promises. And you could identify that with a couple of things, some statistical, some chronological. I mean, so in 1940, for instance, if you were born in the United States that year, you stood a 90% chance of out-earning your parents. But by the beginning of this century, that number had dropped more than half. So that was a feeling of some kind of loss of confidence in the apparatus. Then there was another thing, which is that you had things like the invasion of Iraq, which, of course, was based on misrepresentation of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction. And I think over time, those moments contributed to a gradual loss of confidence. And the effect was that you had this broad liquefaction of American confidence in the government. And that opened the door to somebody who was, in this case, Donald Trump, who was essentially running against government. That was his platform.
We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. You're listening to the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. I want to talk to you a little bit about the election of Donald Trump. You refer to it as a joint venture between working class voters and well-heeled executives. Break that down for us.
I think often when we talk about the Trump phenomenon, we focus on the populist edge of it, the people in places like Clarksburg, West Virginia, which did, after all, vote for Trump in large numbers. And it's true that he did appeal to that. I think you have to also acknowledge there was a racist message in his campaign that appealed to people, and some people responded to it. There's just no question about the role that he had. But then there was this other thing going on at the top, which was that there were establishment Republicans who at the very beginning said, well, I'll never vote for this guy. He's out of step with my values. He's crude. He's totally out of step with where we imagine the Republican Party should be. But by the end, they had changed their mind and had put themselves in league with him. And I was especially struck with it in Greenwich, because in some ways it's the homeland of the Republican establishment. The Bush family literally is from Greenwich. And so it caught my attention when people started to throw their support to him. And I wanted to understand how that happened, why it is that they imagined that he might be someone who could advance their interests and the interests of the party.
I want to ask you about January 6th. You were actually there at the Capitol. What did you see? What was going through your head? And how did this insurrection unfold in front of you?
Well, I went there as a reporter, of course, for The New Yorker. And I was staggered, honestly, Rena. I did not expect to ever see something like that unfolding here in the city where I live, in the country that I imagine to be immune from those kinds of moments, those expressions of total unbounded rage that I have seen and covered in so many other places. It took a moment for me to calibrate my instruments and sort of get my bearings that morning. But the thing that really struck me about it was not the very angry guys who were running around in camouflage and so on. In some ways, I had come to expect that. I knew there was always going to be this fringe of people who are participating in a kind of political delusion about the idea that they're going to overthrow the government. But what really surprised me was actually the grandmothers, the people who were there, who on a Monday morning would get up and go to work. And they, in fact, had been drawn into this big lie about the idea that the election had been stolen from Donald Trump. And it was when I met them, actually, that I was really shaken, because I began to realize that this had leached out into the broader population to a degree I hadn't fully appreciated. And that was the first indication. I don't think I knew it then, but that was the first indication of the fact that his phenomenon was going to last beyond his presidency, and that we'd be contending with a metastasizing threat, which we now face today.
We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. You're listening to the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. You talk about this metastasizing threat, you know, of all the reporting you did for this book. What really surprised you?
I guess the thing that really surprised me, and this is an encouraging fact, is that we have this weird capacity in this country to recognize when something is getting really dangerous. And it's not as if we, you know, all pull together and say, well, enough of that. Now let's all get back to democracy. But there is, on a level that we don't even, I think, process day to day, a self-corrective mechanism. And I rely a bit, in this case, on the scholarship of people like Robert Putnam at Harvard, who wrote a book recently with Shailen Romney-Garrett about how the Gilded Age gave way to the Progressive Era. And that's a fascinating little scene in history, because it's a moment when Americans, and particularly very privileged Americans, began to look and realize that the system that they believed they had triumphed in was in fact falling apart, and that they had to figure out a way to repair it. And they did, actually. The real history is that they looked at how desperately insecure people felt in this country. And there was an effort to begin to repair the system, not just on the political or policy level, but really on the moral level, to peer into the abyss and say, how did we get into this mess? How did we lose the capacity, or did we ever really have it, to be empathetic towards people unlike ourselves? And what can we do to make it a little better? I was amazed as I talked to people who were, you know, scholars and philosophers and legal activists who are involved in some of the hardest problems around the weaknesses in American democracy are actually some of the people who say, no, no, no. The encouraging fact is we know what some of the solutions are. They're not hiding from us. And you're beginning to see the germination of what I think of as antibodies to the problem, to the illness in American democracy. And I describe in the book how that is beginning to take shape. And I came out of it feeling better than I expected to.
Got to ask you, did you come away with any thoughts on how American society might heal? Were there any beacons of hope?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I was struck by a few things. There is this thread that runs through many people's experience of the power of national service as an ingredient in generating a sense of common good. I mean, to give you one example, in the state of Virginia in the 20th century, Linwood Holton, who was the governor of the state, was the person who implemented Brown versus Board of Ed against the resistance of a lot of people in his own state. And he was a white governor, and people said, why are you implementing the integration of schools? And he said, well, because a GI who served alongside people who did not look like me, black, white, Latino, and none of that mattered. And in fact, we were part of this larger thing, this larger project. And I think there is a power in national service beyond just the idea that it is contributing in a material way. Whether it's military or civilian, it puts you in league with people who are so different than you are that it forces you to imagine yourself as part of something larger than the individual parts. And I think there has been bubbling up over the last few years a push by people like Pete Buttigieg and others to really try to create avenues for much greater national service. And some of this is a matter of law and policy, but also it's really about culture. It's about valorizing it. One of the proposals on the table right now is a national climate corps in this tradition of the Civilian Conservation Corps after the Great Depression that would take young people and put them into work alongside one another to mitigate the effects of climate change. And that's a powerful idea.
Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Evan, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Rena. Thank you.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. The U.S. Supreme Court returns for its first in-person arguments since March 2020. Attorneys are expected to wear N95 masks in the courtroom, except when presenting arguments. Only those with negative COVID tests will be allowed in. The rules were in place before Friday's announcement that Justice Brett Kavanaugh tested positive for COVID. All Supreme Court justices have been vaccinated since January. This will mark the first time that Justice Amy Coney Barrett will be physically in the seat once held by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Expected cases over the coming weeks include challenges to abortion rights, gun regulations, and whether the death penalty applies to the 2013 Boston Marathon bomber. Britain will begin deploying military tanker drivers to help deliver fuel in London and southeast England today. The goal is to stabilize a national supply after a week of panic buying. The fuel shortage is partially due to a driver shortage caused by Brexit and also due to an aging workforce and the coronavirus pandemic. Today marks the 94th anniversary of the construction of Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. In an effort to promote tourism, historian Dwayne Robinson came up with the idea to celebrate the first 150 years of American history. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln were each chosen because of their role in preserving the Republic and expanding its territory. It took over 400 workers and a little over 14 years to finish the project. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you back tomorrow. This is a Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Evan Osnos, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury, for being on the show. If you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and do leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.